Last week we spoke about we called Din Torah, Dine Doraita, Biblical Law. If you look on the schedule of classes, what we're basically doing right now are constructing the various elements that are going to be at play within basically almost every area of halakha, every area of Jewish law. So when you talk about any area of halakha, there's always going to be looking at the biblical framework, the rabbinic framework, any customs that are related to it, and so on and so forth. Now we're kind of looking at each one independently, but we're also going to be talking about how they interact with each other, how they build with each other. As we go through these kind of building block topics, we're going to mention different examples of these things, but I think when you're going to be able to really grasp them is once we move on to the second and third trimester of the course. At that point, we're going to go through specific areas of law, you know, devoted to those areas. There you're going to be able to really see how all these parts come together and create, you know, the framework through which the practical halakha plays out. So last week we spoke about Din Torah, biblical law. We spoke about the significance of what it meant to be a biblical law, why it's important to kind of define. We said, you know, we keep all the laws, but to define whether something is biblical or rabbinic. We spoke about the biblical laws are one of three categories, either things that are explicit in the Bible, that's the most obvious. We mentioned that interpretations based on biblical interpretation is considered to be biblical law as well because it's rooted in the biblical text. And then the other category, which we also said is biblical law, are things that have nothing to do with the biblical text. But there's a tradition that it was told to Moshe on Har Sinai. So halacha le Moshe mi Sinai. And so those three categories, those are considered to be Din Torah, biblical law. And we spoke about that, in fact, a little bit about the nature of the way that those different areas operate, and the actual degree of flexibility within those laws. Each generation, you know, can do the reinterpretation. We've lost that skill today, but at least conceptually, that reinterpretation or that application of the rules of exegesis would have been happening in every generation. Today, we just kind of look at what the Talmud said regarding those particular exegesis. But at least conceptually, that flexibility was built into it. What we're going to look at today are Dinei Derabbanan, what we call rabbinic laws. Now, based on the fact that we already put things that are based on interpretation into the biblical law category, so what we call rabbinic laws is a much smaller area, right? Meaning the majority of the Talmud is biblical law, but rabbinic law certainly does play an important role within it. And we're going to talk about that tonight. There's basically two categories of Dinei Derabbanan. One term which is used are gzerot, which are fences, and then you have the area which are referred to as takanot, enactments. And those words are written in on the outline of your sheet. Generally speaking, you sometimes can find words used slightly differently in different places, but generally speaking, when we refer to gezerot, fences, and we're going to look at the sources behind these, what gives them the right, you know, what's the source of their authority to do these things. Generally speaking, gezerot are these fences, right? It's an Aramaic word. I guess in modern Hebrew, geder is how you would say a fence, but you often find between Aramaic and Hebrew, zayin and dalet switch or interchangeable. So you'll find that the gezerot are meant to protect one or to create a situation in which a person will not come to transgress a biblical law. So, for example, you know, famous kinds of gezerot are don't eat milk and meat together, or even wait between eating milk and meat, because a word you may come to actually eat milk and meat which has been cooked together. Right, so in order that a person should eat milk and meat which is cooked together, we say you should really separate even between eating milk and meat completely. Right, that's a famous gezerah, which was enacted. Or, you know, the famous one Mishnah quotes is, you know, don't play a musical instrument on Shabbat, because if it breaks, you might want to, you know, fix the string on your guitar, right? It happens, I play guitar, right? Your string breaks. You know, if it's part of your performance is to use a guitar and it breaks, all of a sudden, what are you going to do? You're going to fix the string, right? Fixing the string is prohibited on Shabbat. So, enactment, no music playing on Shabbat, right? Just examples of gzerot that you find within the Mishnah and the Talmud. You then have takanot, which are enactments. Again, these aren't a hard and fast definition, but generally speaking, you find these words are used in two different ways. Generally speaking, takanot, enactments, have to do with not necessarily creating a fence around something, but when the rabbis made a law that they thought was a good idea. So, two most famous takanot are Purim and Chanukah. What? Right? They're not in the Bible, right? Well, I mean, Purim is mentioned in the rest of the Bible, but when we talk about Bible as far as biblical laws, as we mentioned last week, we mean the five books of Moses. So one, obviously Megillah isn't part of that, so Purim is considered to be a rabbinic holiday. Chanukah is considered to be a rabbinic holiday. So those are going to be takanot. And we'll see, you know, in further classes, different topics we're going to do. We'll see other takanot that have been set up, whether ketuvah maybe is takana and so on. We'll look at the various areas when we get to them. So those are the two categories that we generally refer to when we refer to rabbinic laws. What I want to look at together with you is the source of that authority. Why can rabbis do this? Why is that require anything of me? Because a group of rabbis got together and decided that this is what the law should be. We're going to look at even some interesting things that sometimes they do things that seem to even go against the Torah, and really, you know, what's going on in those situations. We're going to look at the extent in that conversation. What's the extent of their authority? You know, we just broad terms, but are there limits to what the rabbis can do? How far is their power go? And then to look at as well, as this would be relevant to we spoke about within the interpretations, we're going to look at it tonight as far as when can things change or how do things change. We'll talk about that next week regarding, in 2 weeks when we talk about minhag, custom. That'll be that'll be relevant for each of these topics. And each of these various areas change in different ways and at different times. And that's why within any area of law, you really need to break down all its elements, because when you talk about application, interpretation, change, whatever the case may be, you need to know what aspect of the law you're talking about and what kind of law is it when you discuss it. Are you talking about a biblical or rabbinic? What kind of biblical? What kind of rabbinic? What kind of custom? There's different kinds of customs, right? And each of these things have their own mechanisms for how they function. And so it'll be important to be able to distinguish between these things, you know, when then a rabbi or someone is going to sit down to try to figure out what the law is going to be in a given situation. They've got to be able to make all these differentiations and understand why the differentiations matter in order to render a competent legal decision. So that's a little bit what we're doing together. Okay. So let's start. I go a little bit out of order from what we have in our sheets over here. I want to start with looking at what's the source? You know, what's the source that the rabbis, and people can do whatever they want, but what's the source for the fact that it has some kind of binding applicability to me when a group of rabbis in the Talmud say, don't play music on Shabbat, don't eat milk and meat together, whatever, right? Great, that's good for you, but why should I do that? That's not written in the Torah, right? What authority do they have? So let's look. Okay, we'll start with that. We'll start with the gezeirot. Let's look at source number five. We're going to skip around a little bit. Source number five. It says, this is a pasuk in Vayikra, in Leviticus, that says as follows. It says, Ushmartem et mishmarti, you shall keep my charges, in order that you should not come to, you know, make these transgressions. I am the Lord your God. So, okay, it says, Mishmartem et Mishmarti. Here the Sifra, we spoke about that in the summer. The Sifra is that text written, midrashic, halachic text written in or compiled in the 3rd century, the same time of the Mishnah and the Tosefta. So these are early early texts, right? This is before the time of the Talmud. These are the texts where it goes through verse by verse, quoting the interpretations, right? The Talmud ends up being discussions. Things are all kind of more organized topically. The Midrash Halakha is organized just in the order of the Bible, just going through verse by verse the interpretation. So here, on this verse, the Sifra, which is the name of that particular Midrash Halakha, says, what does it mean? It says, you shall keep my charge. What does that mean? Preserve a safeguard for me and guard my charge, i.e. my laws. This is an instruction to the court. Right? So this was understand the fact that the way that the Pasuk was written, this double language, Mishmartem et Mishmarti, not just that you shall guard my watches, right? This language of Shmirah, of watching, that was understood to mean that there is this notion of be really careful. Meaning go beyond the straight law, but do what you need to do in order to guard against any kind of transgression. And it was understood that the Ushmartem, in the language that was written, was a reference to the courts. Right? This is not, something just given to individuals of, you know, you do it, you know, be careful. But no, it was understood to mean that this was a charge given to the courts themselves. Now, there's others who, we're going to quote other verse in a moment in reference to Takanot, that some also felt was actually perhaps a reference to the authority of rabbis to make these fences as well. But this is one of the very, very early sources that already quotes this verse of Ushmartem et Mishmarti, guard my statutes, or keep my charge, as a reference or as a empowerment to the courts to make these fences, right? And that these fences would therefore be binding upon the community. Okay, so that's the source for the Gzer. Let's look at what the Talmud says is the source for Takanot. Where does it come from that they can make Chanukah and obligate me to do that? So here's interesting. It's interesting the way that it's written in source number 2. It says in the tractate of Shabbat, that's where the topic of Chanukah is discussed. And it says as follows. It says, Rabbi Chiya Bar Ashi said, he who lights the Chanukah lamp must pronounce a blessing. What benediction is uttered? This, who sanctified, right? You say, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Kiddishanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu L'hadlik Ner Shal Chanukah. So what do you say? Blessed are you, God, King of the universe, who commanded us to light the Chanukah candles, right? Who sanctified us by his commandments and commanded us to kindle the lights of the Chanukah. So the Talmud says, wait a second. When did he ever command us? Why do we say, blessed are you, God, who commanded us? I'm pretty sure Chanukah happened. God never commanded us. It's not in the Bible. We never were commanded to do so. So Rabbi Avia said, it follows from the following verse. And we'll look at the verses in a moment. You shall not turn aside. Lo tasur. We'll look in a moment at that verse. Rabbi Nechemia quoted a different verse. He said, it comes from the verse of Shal Avicha V'Agedcha. Ask your father, and he will show you, your elders, and they will tell you. So they quote different verses for the source of this law. So let's look at these sources. And again, there's different opinions between the Rambam and Ramban exactly which verse is referring to which kind of power of the rabbis. You know, when is it referring to the rights of biblical interpretation? When is it referring to a gezerah? When is it applied to a takana? But I'm kind of presenting one, at least, perspective on what each group of verses are actually understood to be doing. So, let's look at these verses in Deuteronomy, because this is one of the really most important, this is really like the one grouping of verses that are this very clear directive towards court systems that seem to be implied in the Torah. It says, if there arise a matter too hard for you in judgment, between blood and blood, between plea and plea, between stroke and stroke, probably a reference to different categories of law, laws of purity, impurity, laws of civil, laws of ritual matters, right? These different categories of law, even matters of controversy within thy gates, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God shall choose, meaning go up to the Beit HaMikdash, right? That's where the court will be sitting. And you shall come to the priests, the Levites, right? Those are the ones who acted as the judges at that time. And unto the judges that shall be in those days, and you shall inquire and say, they shall declare unto you the sentence of the judgment. Meaning they shall render what is the law in the given case. Right? They are the experts in the Torah. They will tell you what the law is. And you shall do according to the tenor of the sentence which they shall declare to you from that place which the Lord shall choose. And you shall observe to do according to all that they shall teach you. Listen to what they say, right? You're obligated to listen to their judgment. If you want their source sheets on the table over there. Okay? According to the law which they shall teach you, and according to the judgment that they shall tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the sentence which they shall declare to you, to the right hand, nor to the left. So, this one approach within, right, according to Rabbi Avia, it already told us, listen to what they have to tell you to do. Why the addition? Don't turn to the left. Don't turn to the right. Right? Lo tasur. So that's coming to tell you that they have the right to make enactments. Right? That even if they go beyond what the law itself says and they say, you know what, you also have to do this, you got to listen. I mean, the Torah is giving, is empowering them to do that. I saw, it's fun reading this book that I've been using by Menachem Alon as a Supreme Court Justice, because he really formulates everything so beautifully. And he says, he presents this, this idea that the legislative authority of the rabbis is the biblical authority. Meaning the Bible is the one that empowers them to do that, right? So, in a sense, they're not going against the Torah, right? What they declare is considered to be a part of the Torah, because the Bible itself legislates that they have legislative authority, right? And that then changes the nature of that. So obviously the question is, well, then who's the rabbi, right? Who gets the, so that's, right? But at that time they had the Sanhedrin, right? There was the centralized court. And so that, right, they were the ones who had that kind of authority. And the truth is, today we don't have that. And so we don't make takanot. We don't make gezerot that are at least binding in the biblical sense of those words, or the Talmudic sense of those words. Right? Sometimes rabbis will get together and say, you know, people should stop having such fancy weddings, or, you know, or rabbis may render legal decisions about what's the law in the, you know, in this particular situation, right? I mean, they're just, but they're just applying what's already been said. They're not legislating, right? So here it's talking about the ability to legislate, but that the authority of the rabbis, their legislative authority, is part of the Bible itself. Yes?
I want to just go back to source number six.
Yeah. Right, that's what I said. This is like from the same time period of the Mishnah. Right? Meaning it's not an explicit, the other source we said here wasn't explicit either. Right? What exactly it's referring to, right? This was how they understood that verse. That this verse was a charge to make additional enactments, right? About fences. Shmartem et mishmarti, right? Guard my shomrim, right? Meaning make these guardings, right? And that was understood to mean that there is a biblical imperative to not just follow the letter of the law, but to set up additional laws so that one should not come to transgress the biblical law itself, and that was understood to be an imperative to the court.
Now, I understand that.
But it's not a... It's quoting a biblical verse and understanding what it means. But this source itself is the rabbi. I mean, this is rabbis writing this. Right? So you can say, oh, well, the rabbis are saying that's what the Bible means. Okay. But I mean, that was how they understood this verse. Right? That this verse, written in the way that it was written, was a charge to the court. Okay. So let's now look at the second. Right? We saw there was a debate in the Tractate of Shabbat about Chanukah. Right? What authority do the rabbis have to make, to legislate an additional law? So, it says in Deuteronomy, another verse, right? This is in Ha'azinu, right? The beautiful song towards the end of the Torah. And there it says, Zechor yimot olam binushno dor vador, sha'ala vecha v'yagad chazekinacha v'yomru lach. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Some say this is an imperative to study history. Ask thy father, I like history, so it works. Ask thy father, and he will declare unto you, your elders, and they will tell you. Meaning here, it's this notion of, you know, of ask them what to do. So you see, oh, the fact that you're being told, go to them, means that they have the authority to tell you what to do. Right? And that this was understood, at least according to Rabbi Nehemiah, as a source for the legislative authority of the elders. Right? Elders meaning the elders, as the term is typically used in the Bible, not meaning... You know, grandpa, right? But a reference to the elders, right? The sages, right? And that's what this is meant to, this is what it's meant to mean. And so that you see from here, again, this notion of authority given to the sages. Okay. So, fine. Good. That gives them the right? That gives the authority to the rabbis to legislate, to make laws, to make enactments, to create barriers, so preventative measures, so that one should not come to transgress what the Torah says. There is, however, a problem. Right? There's a problem or a question about the situation. So for that, we have to look at another verse. This will kind of lead to the discussion about what are the parameters. I mean, can they just say anything? Right? What are the rules for this? Are there rules for this legislative authority? So first, the question is that there seems to be a blatant contradiction to the whole notion of rabbinic authority in another verse in the Torah. And that's source number one. This is also in Deuteronomy, in Devarim, and it says... It says, "Et kol ha-davar asher anochi mitzaveh etchem, oto tishmeru, everything that I've commanded to you, that you shall do. Lasot, lo tosef alav, do not add to it, v'lo tigra mimenu, and do not detract from it. What I have told you to do is the law. Don't make any additions, don't make any subtractions from the law."
Did you just say it? They are supposed to enact the laws and make sure that you don't transgress.
Right. So the question is it goes against another verse in the Torah. So why? So what's going on over here? How could that be?
One's contradicting the other.
They seem to be contradicting each other. So, anybody have any thought? How would you deal with this contradiction?
Well, they're clarifying it rather than adding or subtracting. They're making clear. More understandable what's already there.
But they're not, right? When they say don't eat milk after eating meat for, you know, hours, that's not a clarification of law. No one is saying that is what the Bible meant. It's for sure not. When they say you can't eat chicken and milk, there's one opinion that says that that's prohibited biblically, but typically we don't consider that to be a biblical prohibition. So no one's saying that's a clarification. That's the rabbi said that that's what you should do. They're adding laws. Lo tosif alav. Don't add. Get off my back.
Yeah, I think it's similar to reconciling Gamesh of Ezekiel with the rest of the Torah. And the laws which expression of laws in Ezekiel seem to be adding on to what is in the Torah.
Okay. So the question is, what right? I mean, the Bible says you're not allowed to do that. Anybody else? This is a chance for a discussion. Isn't it? Yeah.
Could it be essentially that the rabbis are acting, in a sense, as Hashem's agent, and they have the authority to interpret, you know, such verses, for instance, you know, the lemon in its mother's milk and so forth. They have the authority as an agent, if you will, to be able to interpret that for the community.
So again, if they're interpreting, so fine. So we're going to say, you know, they're just interpreting what the verse means. That's not adding. But here we know they're adding. No one is stating this is what the verse means. The verse does not mean you need to wait after eating meat before you eat milk. Doesn't mean that. No one says that that's what it is. They're coming along and saying you shouldn't do that. Not just you shouldn't, you're not allowed to.
Could it be possible that the prohibition on adding is a prohibition on the individual members of the community? However, the leader has you can't allow everybody to say what. That they have to do something extra as attributed. However, the leader has to declare that everybody has to do something.
Okay, so I think I know what you're saying, right? So you're making the distinction saying it's the prohibition is against individuals, but the courts, that for them they're empowered to do that. So that's a position of the Rashba, who lived in medieval Provence. He was of that position. He said the distinction is that individuals versus courts, right? That individuals aren't allowed to add or take away, but that the courts are not allowed to do so, but that the courts are permitted to do so. So that was a opinion. It's not the majority opinion, but that position is quoted. I didn't mention it. Over here, the source for if you want to look up that Rashba. The other position is mentioned by the Rambam. Right, so, the Rambam tends to be authoritative about why this is not a contradiction. Right? Again, on one hand, it says you're not allowed to. On the other hand, that's what the rabbis tend to do. Right? That's what the courts are doing. They're always making the laws. So the Rambam says the prohibition isn't that you are not allowed to make additional laws. The prohibition isn't that you're not allowed to take away from the laws. What the prohibition is to make a statement or to say that this is what you have to do on biblical grounds when it's not on biblical grounds. Right? To the Rambam, it's all about how do you present this. Rambam says, as long as when the rabbis get up and say, you must observe Hanukkah, they say, this is a rabbinic law. Or when they say, you have to wait after eating meat, they say, this is a rabbinic law, that's okay. The only prohibition is to get up and to say, this is what God said. Right? The courts aren't allowed to get up and say, this is what God requires of us. That is called the Navi Sheker. That's called the false prophets. And false prophets we put to death. Right? That you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to say something in the name of God that God didn't actually say. That's what this prohibition is about. But as long as they state very clearly, this is our enactment. We think it's a good idea to celebrate Hanukkah. We're making it a law. We think that in order that you should not come to eat milk and meat together, that it's necessary to wait after eating meat before you eat milk. But that's what we are legislating that you do. Our authority comes from the Bible, but it's our legislation. According to the Rambam, that's okay. The only thing that they're not allowed to do is to say, you know, we're just going to pull the wool over their eyes. in order to get them to follow us. This is what the Bible says. Oh, what do you mean? Where does it say in the Bible? Trust us. This is what the Bible says. Right? So that is what they're prohibited from doing. Right? So he doesn't say it's a communal individual thing. He says it's all about in the way that it's presented. Right? You can't misinform the people. You have to. You have the right to make legislation, but you have to be very clear about what the source of that legislation is. Yeah.
How did we ever get, you keep mentioning the meat and the milk, how did we ever get to this position where Eastern European Jews, the law is to wait 6 hours, and Dutch Jews only wait 1 hour, and German Jews wait 3 hours?
That's not the topic of our discussion tonight, but the quick answer is that the Bible says that you should not eat milk at the same meal as you eat meat. Right, it says you should.
So a Dutch rabbi said this. And a
so it seems that it developed a little bit differently about exactly when the Talmud says you should wait, you shouldn't go eat milk and meat at the same meal. Did that mean literally at the same meal, but a little while after, no problem? Or when it said not at the same meal, did it mean the amount of time that usually passes between meals, and that became set that that's typically 6 hours.
In different communities,
it was exactly. Yeah.
So, can you be a religious Jew and not practice according to what the rabbis say?
Well, according to this, I mean, I'm not here to judge anybody, but the point is that the rabbis are authorized by the Bible to legislate. So that means that the obligation to follow the rabbis doesn't stem from the rabbis, it stems from the Bible itself. And so to transgress what the rabbis say is in effect the transgression of the Bible, meaning the Bible sets up a legal system. That legal system empowers the courts to enact legislation. If a person doesn't follow that legislation, you're right, the legislation you're breaking is the rabbi's legislation, but the rabbis are authorized to do that, or empowered, or encouraged, almost seems, to make legislation when they feel that that's the appropriate thing to do. And so the binding authority of it is from the Bible, right? So if a person believes the Bible, so then if you believe in the binding authority of the Bible, so then this is part of that authority. Okay, so that's the way the Rambam understood the distinction between this. Now, what I want to look at, though, because it goes further about, well, to what extent, right? What is the extent of rabbinic authority, right? How far can they go? So here it becomes something important, because it's one thing for me to make a fence. Say, you know, I don't want you to end up, you know, fixing a musical instrument, so playing music on Shabbat is prohibited. Okay, fine. I can understand when they say, celebrate Purim. You're obligated to hear the Megillah read on Purim. Okay. But what about when the rabbis legislate that when Rosh Hashanah falls on a Shabbat, don't blow the shofar? Whoa, that's already something different, right? There's a biblical obligation on Rosh Hashanah, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, right? A biblical obligation to blow the shofar, even if it's Shabbat, right? There's no dispensation because it's Shabbat. The rabbis come along and say, you know, we're worried that people might come to carry a shofar in a place where there is not an eruv, and therefore, don't blow shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbat. That's right. That's already something different. And yet, right, that was understood that that also was part of that authority. Right, that their authority means they can even tell you to disregard a law of the Torah. And again, as long as they're clear that it's not what the law truly is, but it's based on their rabbinic authority that they're doing it, they have that right. Right? They are empowered, but it's not a contradiction to the Bible. because the Bible empowers them to legislate as they see fit, even if that legislation at times is to not follow what other things in the Bible say. Right? Very far-reaching authority. But that's, right? Meaning, people talk about, oh, the Bible is ossified, right? It's outdated. The point is, there is legislative authority would, right? Again, we don't have that system set up today in exile, right? But ideally, that the rabbis or the courts, right, the high court, has the ability to legislate even to some extent, right, to transgress the Torah. That's a very, right, extreme kind of legislative authority. The question is there a to what extent is that? Is it to anything? Can their legislation be don't keep the Torah? I mean, you know what? And then say, oh, but since our authority comes from the Torah, that is the Torah. The Torah is to not keep the Torah. Meaning, at what point does that become ridiculous? Right? What are the limits to that authority? What I want to make clear is that it was clearly understood that this authority went beyond just adding or doing fences, but it meant that they could even sometimes go against the go against what the Torah had to say. Yeah.
What happens when according to rabbinic authority, what happens if the two rabbis disagree?
Well,
now, there might be Hillel and Shammai, and there was an easy compromise with the mezuzah being a slip. What happens if there isn't?
So again, part of the issue comes down to... No, you're right. So, because it's not supposed to be about individual rabbis.
Right?
Right. When you have a court system, so you end up... you take votes. We'll have a class where we're going to talk about, you know, how decisions are made. But right, there's a rule in the Torah that says, Achrei Rabim Lahato, you follow the majority rule. So you have the Sanhedrin, you have the high court. You know, in theory, it would have been Hillel comes, Shammai comes, all the rabbis come. They each present their arguments, and they vote. And that's the decision, right? That becomes right. Time of Hillel and Shammai was the time of Roman rule. The Sanhedrin wasn't in function. And the Talmud even talks about that those last 100 years of the Talmud, of the Temple, Second Temple, there were debates flowered and mushroomed, disagreements. And then there was this time after the destruction of the Temple when the rabbis finally got back together where they tried to legislate a bunch of those things. That works a lot with the Talmud is deciding. It quotes disputes and says, this is the position you should follow. Right? Because it needs to deal with the fact that so many positions had, you know, come to the floor. So again, this stuff doesn't apply to me, right? The rabbi. Right? Meaning we're dealing right now kind of like with a Jewish court, right? And a typical Jewish court today does not have this authority. We're talking about Jewish court when we had a true court system. But again, in order to understand any halakhic topic, which is what, right, any time a rabbi is going to do that, these things are all the elements which those laws are built on, and a rabbi needs to understand these elements in order to fully understand what the law is in a given case. So the things we're talking about here don't really apply to authorities we have, but if we're going to understand what is going on in any area of law, we need to understand what the elements were at work when that law kind of became formulated. Yes?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, because I know there are, in a lot of the Talmud, there are majority and minority opinions, because there's always a possibility at that time that the courts could go ahead and change what would be the majority.
We're actually going to see that source.
What?
We're actually going to see that source tonight. We'll see that source. Yeah, so what's your question?
Yeah. Ask about, you know, since we don't have the court system today, how could we change anything if it needed changing?
So again, depending on what we're talking about may be different, but you're right, that is a limitation we have, as we're going to see with certain things, right? We don't, that we mentioned last week, we don't do biblical exegesis anymore. So even though in theory it was the right of the Jewish court in every generation to, you know, most of the time they followed whatever the previous generation did, but they had, in theory, had the authority to say, you know, we actually think this was done incorrectly. We think this is the right way to do it. Right? This is the way the verse should be interpreted. And we don't have that knowledge anymore. We don't have that court system, right? So in some ways, we just now look to the Talmud and whatever kind of their final decisions were, that's what we use going forward. Okay? You know, so that's, you know, in that regard, where Talmudic Jews, not biblical Jews, right? Just because it's the decisions or the interpretations that the Talmud presents that we consider to be the authoritative decisions about how the Bible is supposed to be practiced. Okay? So, what exactly are the frameworks? So, within the period of the Mishnah, it's not entirely clear what are their parameters, what the extent of parameters are. In the Talmud, there's lengthy discussions about, whoa, this can get out of control, right? This perhaps, you know, can go too far. Now, did they create these limits because they were worried that maybe a court would fly off its handle and say, oh, the law is don't keep the law, right? Or was it that these were the rules at play even during the times of the Mishnah? Unclear. But the ideas are formulated, at least presented, in the Talmud, right? So in the period of the Amoraim. And they present a couple of different ideas. So the one major distinction, and it's actually a bit of a debate, but the major ruling that we consider to be the final decision is that when the rabbis have the right to legislate against a law in the Torah that's only in the realm of shev v'al ta'aseh, of, you know, do no harm, not kum v'aseh, not proactive transgression. So they can tell you, don't blow the shofar on Shabbat because you're not doing anything. You're simply sitting down. You're refraining from doing that. But they can't tell you to transgress a law, right? They can't tell you, eat milk cooked with meat. That's a biblical law, based on a drasha, right? That's considered biblical law. That they can't tell you to do. That's going too far. They can only tell you, we think in this situation you shouldn't fulfill a mitzvah. They can never tell you to transgress a mitzvah, right? That's the conclusion the Talmud reaches. Now, the Talmud then has this discussion. I think this is all in Tractate of Yevamot. Then has this discussion where it looks back at different laws promulgated by the Tanaim, where it seems that they did go against, in a proactive way, laws of the Torah. And through that discussion, they formulate exceptions, right? Situations where it is considered okay, or in a sense, either it's okay to do that, or that's not really what they're doing. There's other things at play in the situation. So that's what these next few list over here in C, you know, 1, 2, 3, that's what those are referring to. So let's look at the first one. The first one is a concept. I'll just kind of go through, just have a sense about some of these ideas, of a notion of hefker beit din hefker. That this was understood, we'll look at the verse in a second, in Ezra, that the rabbis have the right to change financial ownership. Right? That's one of the powers of the rabbi. That the rabbi can say that those $10 are her $10. Right? That they have that authority to transfer wealth in that way. It's based on a verse, let's look at it over here, it's source number 7. There's another verse which is quoted elsewhere, but we'll just look at this one. Source number 7 in the book of Ezra. And it says, and they made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem unto all the children of the captivity that they should gather themselves together into Jerusalem. Right? They called out, everyone, come to Jerusalem. And that whoever came not within 3 days, and if you didn't follow this ruling, according to the council of the princes and the elders, all his substance should be forfeited, and himself separated from the congregation of the captivity. Meaning, if you don't come, we're confiscating your property. Okay? And from here, the Talmud understands that that's authority of the court, that the court has the right to confiscate property. This led to the right of the rabbis to do a couple enactments. I'll just quote to you a couple, two examples. So one example is When I purchase goods, in theory, let's say I want to buy that painting. So I go to, let's say the president of the synagogue has that right, or I go right, and I go to the president. I say, I'm going to buy that for $100,000, and he says, great, excellent. I go ahead and I give him $100,000. According to the Bible, that painting is mine. The rabbis came along and they said, we see a problem here, right? Because that's fine when this painting is here. But what if I go to someone and I say, you know what? You have a grain house in Oklahoma, and I'm going to purchase the grain in your, you know, in your silo for, you know, $20 million. So I wire the money to your bank account, and then you say, great, good, and you take a walk from your silo. Now, it's going to take me a day to get to your silo to go pick up all the grain. In the meantime, people come and steal it, a fire catches, it burns down, and I'm out my money. So the rabbis made a law. They said, you know what? The transfer of money is not going to be the thing that transfers ownership. The thing that's ultimately going to transfer ownership is taking possession. Is taking possession of something. And to that extent, they said, only once I actually take that painting into my hand is that painting mine. In theory, if that painting got ruined, if the silo burned down before I took it into my hand, I get the money back. I haven't acquired it until I take my hand. Even though, on a biblical level, it was mine. According to the Bible, it was mine. The rabbis are still going to obligate the person that I purchased it from to give me the money back. Right? And that's given based on that authority that the rabbis, right, that the court decided, right, or understood that's an exception, that they have the right to transfer wealth. In theory, that's one of the powers rabbis have when it comes to marriage. In theory, that they can say, you know, that money that you get. Now, again, the parameters of this are complicated. There's big debates today, obviously, because of the issue of aguna. But conceptually, right, that the rabbis, in certain situations, whether it's applied to aguna, is, again, maybe we'll talk about when we talk about matrimony, we'll talk about aguna situation. But at least in certain situations where they felt that a marriage was an inappropriate marriage, biblically, they got money, right? He gave her the money. She accepted it. There were witnesses there. He said, I'm giving this money for marriage. And then the rabbis come along and they say, you know, that marriage was inappropriate. That was a situation of, you know, there had been a rape involved or, you know, whatever the situation is. The rabbis say, you know what? The money you gave her, you never gave her. That money's been confiscated, right? To the extent that now that woman's not married. She goes ahead, has relations with another man, gets pregnant, has a baby, that baby is not considered a mamzer. We consider as if she is a single woman, even though biblically she is married. But this ability of Hefker, Beit Din Hefker, to confiscate the wealth works even to the point on a biblical level to change the status of a married woman, which is a very, right, it's considered to be a very severe kind of situation because of the problem of mamzerim, even to the extent of annulling that. That's very powerful, right? That's a very powerful power of the Beit Din. So that would be, let's say, one of those kind of exceptions. Another exception is makin v'onchin shelo min ha-Torah, that they're allowed to impose physical, the courts are allowed to impose physical punishments, even though they're not biblically mandated or authorized to do so. So let's say there's a situation, according to the Bible, in order to punish someone, there needs to be two witnesses, they have to pass a whole myriad of tests. Let's say for whatever reason the rabbi say, you know what, this is getting out of control, there's some kind of, you know, ongoing deception that's happening, they say, you know what, we're going to impose a punishment anyway. According to the Bible, you're not allowed to hit someone unless you're authorized to hit them, right? You're certainly not allowed to kill someone, right? It's murder, right? It's certainly murder if you kill someone unless the Torah mandates to put somebody to death. So outside of that context, it's considered murder. The Beit Din, though, has the right to do that, right? The court system has the right to do that in a situation where they feel that that is the correct decision to do so, even though, besides without authority, the court has just committed murder. But they actually have that authority to do that. And then the other kind of exception that the Talmud quotes, again, all these things are based on different verses. The other exception that it understands is the notion of horacha, religious needs. That if there's a sense that we have to allow it in this situation for a religious purpose, they have the right to do that. Right? So the most famous of that is the fact that I've written all these sources down on a piece of paper, and according to biblical law, the oral law is not supposed to be written down, it's supposed to be oral. The Talmud says, because of a fear that the tradition would be lost, that it was permitted to write it down. Right? That was transgressing. So for religious needs, haracha, that there was also sometimes considered okay to actively, for the rabbis, the courts, to act to permit active transgression. Again, these are not things that we really have authority to today because we don't have court systems, at least in the classic sense of the term. But at least in understanding different laws that we'll look at throughout the year, it's important to understand that this is stemming from the notion of far-reaching rabbinic legislative authority given to them by the Bible. It goes even further than one might think, perhaps particularly because of that, even though it is far-reaching, but it's defined. Right, there's specific areas for particular way in which that authority is allowed to be done. It's not they can just do whatever they want. There is a framework. It's a far-reaching framework, but there is a framework for how that authority functions. And there's examples in the Talmud of all these different kinds of legislations. What's interesting about this, again, here we're not talking about biblical interpretation. That's a different story. Tonight we're all talking about legislation. Right, rabbinic legislation, making enactments, setting up these fences, so on and so forth. Gezerot. So what's fascinating is that their authority of the courts was not total. They didn't have, even at times when they had this authority, that authority was not total. It was not a complete top-down kind of authority, meaning the legislation came from the top, but the community played a role in whether that law would be considered authoritative. What do I mean? I want to read to you what the Rambam says. It's based on sources in the Mishnah and the Talmud. We'll just read the Rambam because he states it clearly. This is source number 8. It says, when a court sees it necessary to issue a decree, institute an edict, or establish a custom, they must first contemplate the matter and see whether or not the majority of the community can uphold the practice. They have to assess. We think this is a good idea. We think that this should be done, but are people going to be able to do it? Is it going to work? We never issue a decree on the community unless the majority of the community can uphold the practice, right? If there's not a belief that the majority can do it, then it doesn't, then we don't, the rabbis, the courts aren't supposed to make that law. They need to make an assessment. Now what if they make an incorrect assessment? So that's what the next part says. It says, if a court issued a decree thinking that the majority of the community could uphold it, and after the decree was issued, the majority of the community raised contentions, and the practice did not spread throughout the majority of the community, the decree is nullified. The court cannot compel the people to accept it. Right? So this is amazing, right? Meaning they have legislative authority given to them by the Bible, but it only goes so far as if the people are willing to accept it. Right? If the people weren't willing to accept a particular enactment, then the enactment falls by the wayside. And the Talmud quotes enactments that the rabbi said, and they didn't stick. And so the enactment isn't obligatory to us. Right? So there kind of was this balance system that was in place so that whatever enactments were made, right? So which means the enactments that we do follow, it's because, again, it's the rabbis had reasons for making the enactments. They would say, this is a rabbinic law. We think this is a good idea. And generally speaking, people said, we agree. We think that's a good idea. And they followed the majority of the people followed the law to the extent that then it became binding legislation. But at the time of the enactment, the people said, "Well, you know, this is beyond." Then the enactment wouldn't take hold. So that's an important kind of limiting factor on this issue. Now, rabbinic laws, how do they change? So we saw that when it came to the biblical laws, right, laws built on interpretation, every court, every generation have the right or the privilege to go back to the biblical text, take their 13 rules out of their pocket and say, what do they think, you know, the correct interpretation of the biblical verse is? And they could switch. It could switch. And we know that laws did change over time based on these rules of interpretation. What about these laws? Right? One court decides, you know what? No eating milk after meat. What if 20 years later the next court says, what a silly law. You know, we don't think that that's necessary, let's say. We don't think that's necessary. People are not going to come to eat milk and meat cooked together if, you know, just because they can eat milk right after meat. We think we should. So, they were, the ability to change enactments, because they wrote, was not as fluid as biblical interpretation. Right? This is something we mentioned last week. To some extent, rabbinic laws are stickier than some biblical laws, right, than interpretations are. And that's what was quoted in the Mishnah quote in source number 9. That says as follows. It says, why does the Mishnah cite dissenting views, seeing that the law follows the view of the majority? Why do we quote Machloket? If you look in other ancient texts, legal texts from times of the Mishnah, you do not find differing opinions. You see a stated law. But in the Mishnah, it often quotes dissenting view. It'll tell you which one we follow, but it still quotes the opinions we don't follow. Right? This is one of the amazing things about the Mishnah, right? The, you know, almost like pluralistic nature of the Mishnah. Again, at the end, they were obligated to follow one of the positions, but the fact that it still included the dissension was really quite remarkable. It says, because the court may agree with the dissenting view and follow it. But here's what's important. It says, one court may not overrule another court unless the overruling court is greater than the other in wisdom and number. If greater in wisdom but not in number, or in number but not in wisdom, it cannot overturn the act of the first court. It must be greater in both wisdom and number. And so, I don't know exactly how the number. I'm actually not sure exactly how the number factor worked, and I don't even know how you define greater or less great. But maybe it was a large group of rabbis that still got together. Maybe they expanded the vote. Maybe. I'm actually not sure, to be honest. I'm not exactly sure how this worked. But there basically was this idea that you couldn't have. It wasn't just because, we're the court of this generation. This is what we want to change enactments. No, enactments, because they wrote, once they were put down, unless they were formulated in such a way that said, "This we're making this enactment while these are the conditions." So in that next generation, the court could say, well, the conditions have changed. But if they simply state, you know what, this is the enactment, the next generation could not undo that enactment unless there was a real sense that they were, you know, more significant than the earlier generation court. Which means the enactments were much more, less. They were less fluid or harder to change than at times even biblical laws. Now, on one hand, it seems ironic or seems inappropriate. On the other hand, it probably was necessary, right? It probably is necessary in order to do that, because if a rabbinic law could be changed so easily, chances are people would never follow them. So, to some extent, right, something's a biblical law. Okay, it's a biblical law. People are going to listen. It's a biblical law when it's a rabbinic law. So we say, you know what? In 10 years, they're going to get rid of it anyway. So, and it's just the rabbis. Forget it, I'm not going to do it. So no, in order that there should be a stability to the legal system, when enactments were made, it also means that there has to be a real sense of responsibility among those who made the enactments. They were binding in a way that did not allow them to be changed easily, again, unless it was part of the formulation of the original enactment that it was only enacted under certain conditions. If it was just said, you know, this is the enactment, which often the way it was done, then they became binding. And even if someone says, yeah, it's so outdated, it didn't really make a difference, right? That's the nature of law. And that's one of the important things to think about when thinking about laws. Judaism is a legal system, right? And in order the legal system should be followed, it's not healthy for a legal system to be changed on a whim. Because when a system can change that way, so you say, you know, one week, you know, this is the popular attitude towards something, and next week people's attitudes change. If all of a sudden legal system was just constantly flopping in the wind, it would fall apart, right? So there are mechanisms through which things can change, but it's through a kind of system, a kind of process that allows the legal system to have stability. And so the fact that sometimes things change slowly it can be sometimes frustrating, but it's not a bad thing, right? It allows a legal system to truly function as a legal system. So there's kind of the takeaway from today's class about rabbinic authority is that the rabbinic authority is legislated from the Bible, right? So in a sense, they have biblical legislative power. They needed to make it clear, though, that they weren't stating a biblical law. They still needed to make it clear that what they were doing was a rabbinic law. But as long as they did that, they had the authority to make laws, and even to make laws that at times went against biblical laws within certain parameters, right? There was, again, whether those parameters were, you know, how exactly that came about, were they imposed or whatever it is, there were regulations for it. That being said, once enactments were made, they only worked if the people accepted them. Once the people accepted them, they became binding, and changing them became a sticky matter in order to give them binding authority. So, you know, ultimately, for our intents and purposes, it will be important to distinguish between what is a rabbinic law, what is a rabbinic law. We don't have the power to change any of them, so it's not important for us for that, but it will be important for us to understand the different components and how they work together by making the distinction. Again, it doesn't apply to exactly the binding nature, as we saw, but it will impact, again, the way that the various laws function. So we're going to meet again in 2 weeks, and at that point we're going to look at the role of customs and what exactly, there's different kinds of customs, and exactly the way that they work, and we'll be our march forward to start building how the system works in total.
Can I ask you a historical question that has nothing to do?